I feel as if I should begin my sermon with a word about the importance of metaphor, because for the purposes of this morning's sermon, I am using the text from Deuteronomy, the text that Pat read to us just now. I'm using it as metaphor. It's important for me to say this because if I were to read this passage literally and then present it to you in its original context together with its use historically and contemporarily, I might have a hard time finding anything good to say about it. Taken literally, this is a story about a conquering people getting prepared to wage a bloody war on an unsuspecting population. And this passage is part of a larger pep talk in which Moses, the leader of this band, prepares the armies of the chosen of God to engage in mass slaughter as they take possession of what they understand to be their God-given promised land. And before sending them off to war, Moses commands those who will perpetuate this bloodshed to choose life, which is kind of ironic. Now, I know there's more to this story, that the Israelite armies are also former slaves who, in a great act of justice, God has delivered from under the yoke of Egyptian bondage. And so we're inclined, with really good reason, to cheer for the Hebrews. But now it seems as if God is about to punish the Canaanites for Egyptian sins. And then there's the problem that a lot of people read this passage literally and then use that literal reading to justify the modern state of Israel's treatment of Palestinians. The fact that this passage is not entirely cut and dry and is misappropriated politically makes it hard to preach literally. There simply isn't enough time to untangle it all. Also, today is Earth Day, and I want to preach a creation care sermon. If we were to consider this passage literally, it would have nothing to do with earth care. So three cheers for metaphor. 10 years ago now, the European Council of Churches published a resource for worship services designed to address climate change. And they suggested that while addressing the issue of global warming, preachers should deliver sermons based on today's lesson from Deuteronomy. 10 years ago, I downloaded the European Council of Churches resources, and then I more or less forgot about it until this week, and I decided to take up this decade-old challenge of preaching an earth care sermon based on this morning's passage, which has nothing to do with the subject. Enter then the power of metaphor. As I mentioned earlier, this morning's lesson comes from a larger story that we call broadly the Exodus. In the story, God's people, the Israelites, are living as slaves in Egypt, and God delivers the enslaved people into freedom, leading them through the sea and the desert and eventually across a river into a new life in a promised land where they're told they will live a good life in a place flowing with milk and honey. But then there's this warning which is articulated in this morning's lesson. The good life in the promised land isn't a given. It is there for the taking, but it has to be chosen. There will be struggles, and there will be battles, and there will be temptations. And in the face of such obstacles, the people of God must choose life. And they must choose life by adhering to the law of God, by living ethical and moral and meaningful lives in the land of promise. Now, what does any of this have to do with taking care of the earth? How is this a metaphor for the Christian responsibility to honor and to exercise stewardship over creation? Well, remember the words of Moses. Moses says, "I call heaven and earth as a witness." That's what Moses says as he speaks to the people. "I call heaven and earth as a witness that I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Now choose life that you and your descendants may live and may prosper in the promised land." Well, I'm of the opinion that the purveyors of technological advancement place before us a guarantee of easy living in a promised land. And that promised land is a future world in which the giants of disease and inequality and hunger and poverty and isolation all have been overcome by the nearly divine power of human progress. All we have to do is escape the slavery of past ignorance, go through the sea of hope, wander through the desert of trial and error, cross the Jordan of enlightenment, and conquer the future, making for ourselves a land flowing with milk and honey, or at least modern technology and scientific advancement. And I believe we have, in many ways, crossed that Jordan. And thanks be to God. I actually love living in the modern world. In fact, I'm probably only alive to live in the modern world because I do live in the modern world. As a child, I suffered from chronic ear and sinus infections. And I might not have survived into adulthood without antibiotics. And antibiotics had only been available for 26 years when I was born. To put that into perspective, when I was born a little more than 50 years ago, legally prescribed penicillin was 9 years younger than commercially available cell phones are today. And speaking of cell phones, they're problematic and they're bothersome sometimes, and I really miss payphones. But I wouldn't choose to go back to a life before cell phones. Nor would I choose to live without electricity that goes directly into my house, and I would really dislike living without modern transportation. I like to drive well enough, but more than that, I love trains and airplanes. I also like computers, right? I carry a fountain pen with me everywhere I go because they're eloquent and they're quirky. But I entered college just as personal computers were becoming widely available. And I'm not sure I could have survived college or later seminary without a computer, because in the course of my studies, I had to write a lot of papers, and I am dyslexic. I cannot always read my own handwriting. For one thing, it's messy, but it's not just that. I flip letters when I write, and then I reverse letters when I read, which makes reading my handwriting kind of interesting for me. If I had to write papers in ink and then copy them with a typewriter like my parents did, I think I would have been sort of a basket case in college and seminary. Anyway, I love living in the promised land, this promised land of technological advancement. But like the promised land in the Bible, the promised land of technological advancement is not a magical place. Each day, living in this promised land, we have to make a choice. We can choose life or we can choose death, and we must choose life if we are going to survive. Take, for example, the antibiotics that saved my life as a child, or at least preserved my ability to hear into adulthood. They're wonderful things, those antibiotics, those trained killers in a bottle, as my mother calls them. But in using antibiotics, we have to choose life. We can't simply overprescribe the drugs as we're doing when we administer them to livestock, because the over-administration of antibiotics leads to drug-resistant bacteria, and who wants that? We have to choose life when we live in the promised land. Or consider the cell phone. They are sometimes lifesavers, no exaggeration. How often have people used phones to get help and to report danger and otherwise to keep themselves safe? All the time, right? But in order to make the cell phones, manufacturers need tantalum capacitors, which are made from coltan ore, which, thanks to our ravenous appetite for cell phones, is now extremely valuable. Coltan ore is found in various places around the world, but one of the principal sources for coltan ore is the Congo River Delta, where people are slaughtering one another on a grand scale to gain access to and to control coltan ore and its revenue. Some observers have suggested that the humanitarian crisis created by the world's tantalum lust is the worst humanitarian disaster since the Holocaust. We don't really talk about it much because we don't want to face the fact that we may have to stop buying new cell phones all the time. When it comes to cell phones, we have to figure out how to choose life. Now, cell phones are like computers, right? And computers raise all sorts of questions about how we're going to choose life. Computers, like cell phones, have this amazing capacity for connectivity, which has made the world smaller in wonderful ways. But our connectivity has become a space vulnerable to attack. Our personal information is used to undermine democracy. Our computers ask us to sacrifice our privacy and our individuality. They render us commodities in an information economy. We always have to choose life over death in this promised land where we live. But perhaps the most important and significant way in which we need to choose life has to do with the ways in which living in our promised land of technological advancement is releasing greenhouse gases into our atmosphere, causing the Earth's temperature to rise and the oceans to acidify, and much more. When it comes to the consumption of carbon fuels in our promised land, we as a people have not chosen life. Our internal combustion engines spew exhaust. As often as not, our consumption of electricity is made possible by the burning of natural gas and coal, the former being obtained through fracking, which threatens the health of our aquifers, which store water naturally underground, and the latter being made possible by profoundly destructive mining practices, which remove mountaintops and pollute streams. As a people, we eat too much meat, and we buy too much stuff that has been transported from too far away. As a people, we have not chosen life. By finding ways to avoid driving gasoline automobiles, we haven't done enough to generate power from renewable sources like solar and wind and tides. We haven't learned how to eat vegetables or to buy less stuff or to purchase that stuff from locally owned brick and mortar retail establishments that we've gotten to by walking on our own 2 feet. Now, to be honest, I don't think I need to convince many people here about the importance of choosing life by lowering our carbon output and by limiting our pollution and by mitigating our destruction of natural and fragile habitats. You know this is an important issue. You are familiar with the need to choose life. The problem is, how do we begin to choose life when we feel so powerless to make that choice in important and meaningful ways? After all, the real changes that need to be made have to be made by lawmakers in Washington and in Sacramento. And those people aren't really doing enough to curb greenhouse emissions or to combat climate change. We also need to make significant changes in our economy so that Americans aren't consuming so much or spending so much time in automobiles. We need to change our mentality so that we don't need a new cell phone or a new computer just because the newest version has been released. But how do you and I make such life-affirming choices? How do our choices really make a difference? You and I can choose to purchase an electric car, perhaps, and plug it into a power source generated by solar cells, but that would just be a few of us, right? Who are we in comparison to a president who wants to jumpstart coal production in Appalachia and who wants to drill for oil off the Northern California coast? We could get involved politically, writing letters and raising cane on the streets or even running for office, but who are we? And what are our resources compared to the interests of oil companies and their minions in politics and in the media? It's hard to feel like we can make a difference. It feels like choosing life in this promised land is a meaningless thing to do because it feels insignificant. It feels ineffective. Well, let me say that small individual choices for life, those choices we make individually and together, I actually think they are vitally important. I know they seem small. I know they seem insignificant. But in my opinion, they are vitally important. In fact, I'm convinced that great movements for justice and righteousness begin. They are born out of small choices for life that individuals make, choices that may at first seem small and insignificant and ineffective. The little things we do, the small choices we make, they are like seeds. Now, not every seed germinates, And while a single plant may seem tiny, when a whole bunch of plants grow together, they become a whole field of viable crops. And this is not just wistful Pollyanna optimism either. All of the great movements that have changed the world have been made up of regular people who have made small individual choices for life. Now, we celebrate great leaders like Susan B. Anthony or Martin Luther King or Mahatma Gandhi or Nelson Mandela, but every great leader started her or his work doing something small. And none of them would have made the first bit of difference in the world if it were not for countless individuals who, in small but significant ways, had made a choice for life, and in so doing, supported the overall movement. And so it is. No, so it shall be with the changes necessary to save the earth from the excesses of our life in the promised land of technological advance. There may be great leaders. In fact, there already are great leaders, and some of them are in this sanctuary today. But each one of us needs to choose life. Each one of us needs to join in the work of living into a more sustainable future. And this choice for life can look all sorts of different ways. You know, we can get out of our cars and walk. We can ride a bike. We can take public transportation. We can choose to fix what is broken rather than buying something new. We can plant a garden. We can run for office. We can take long walks in the woods. We can allow ourselves to be overcome with joy when we stand at the edge of a continent looking out at the sea. We can go outside in the quiet of the morning and hear the chorus of birds singing. We can choose life. We can choose to be part of preserving the beauty of God's world, the world that God has given to us as a home, so that when we live in that promised land of technological advancement, we will be living in a land that truly flows with milk and honey, and the promise of Medicare, and the promise of food for all, and the promise of economic opportunities that we're told will attend our technological prowess. May these advancements truly be shared by all, and not just by those who are now alive, but by generations yet unborn, who will share the joy of a creation that we have worked so hard to preserve by choosing life with each and every dawning day. And here's the thing. The word that I've given you today, this idea that with our small individual choices we can choose life, and that choice for life will have a meaningful impact living into the future, this word is not too hard for you. It is not too high for you. It is not too low. It is not somewhere distant that you should have to go off on a quest to find it. No, the word is right here for you to see and observe. See, I call heaven and earth as witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Now, dearly beloved, choose life. Choose life so that you and your descendants may live long and may prosper in this new and promised land. Amen.
Amen.